Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we speak with the key figure of Canberra poetry, Jeff Page. Plus, the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Jeff Page has been a leading voice in Canberra area poetry, indeed in Australian poetry, for many years. When he visited the Art Sound Studios recently, I and my colleagues at Poetry on the Radio, Peter Searles and Peter Monahan, asked him about his most recent book, 101 Poems, 2011 to 2021, Pitt Street Press, a selection from his last decade of publication. We also asked him about how he became a poet and the origins of his interest in jazz and in religion. How did you go about selecting poems for this book? And then, as you were doing that, how did it have you thinking about your whole poetic career?
Well, I think of that book as a fellow to new selected poems that came out in 2012, 2013. And that was the first 40 years of my career, if that's the right word. And then this is the last sort of 10 years or so. And the way I put it together, I simply took the five or seven books over that period and chose what I thought were the best poems from each book that make 101. And I was fairly happy with the way it emerged. You know, I had to shed a few tears about one or two. But
when you do that, do you revise any of them?
A little bit, but not substantially. Some people, like Robert Gray, others have revised extensively, but I might just tweak a line or half a line or a word, you know, but I think once they're in public, they're more or less, you can't fiddle with them anymore. That's just there. I know not everyone thinks that way. I'd rather spend the time working on a new poem than sort of just putting fine detail in another one.
The first poem that I ever encountered of yours is on Poetry Foundation.
Yeah.
The Fundamentalists in Heaven. It was one of those poems I read, and I was just delighted when I got to the end. It gives you a lot to think about, but it sort of happens in a fleeting way, and then there is a final effect.
Yeah. That preoccupation, you know, with religion and fundamentalism, so it's been with me a long time. I've probably got at least 40 or 50 poems about religion, loosely speaking. The fundamentalists in heaven discover they're correct. The mullahs, rabbis and the preachers, the televangelists, complete with sundry flocks and herds, the metaphors have slipped through with them. They're wearing robes like Bedouins from Bible illustrations. The decor's indistinct, but still a kind of Middle Eastern. Palm trees, minarets and fountains, a Cecil B. DeMille affair with hoots of camels in the dusk and something on a pipe or strings threading in the distance. And now the quiet collective sigh, ineffable, of course, at such soft-headedness from God, so much containment through the years inside a single truth. But God somehow disarms them slightly and gives no space to rail. The end of all their expectations is literal an evening light, where they must dwell at least forever, elbowing the saved.
It's a very humorous.
It is a bit.
It is, but it's quiet about it. Even to me, one of the most humorous parts comes in parentheses. You know, it's like a gesture. But elbowing, that choice of verb at the end, elbowing the saved, is just a beautiful word choice because there's just so much suggestion.
They're so crowded and they sort of make room for themselves. And they're doing that all through life as well.
That's right.
And also sure that they're the only one true. That's the joke, you know.
Right. Cool. No, it's true. Would you speak a little bit of sort of about this theme in your writing, since carries through?
An early poem of mine that was fairly well known was Christ of Gallipoli. That was about 1970. There's probably something in my first book even, but I've always been interested in religion. I went to a church school, but it wasn't particularly religious and there was no formal religious instruction. Then at university, I sort of dabbled with Christianity for a couple of years and then gave up on it, so I just wasn't convinced. But I'm not unconvinced either. And then ever since then, you know, since I was about 22, 21, I've been an agnostic. I like to think of myself as an agnostic, so I don't dismiss religious belief in just a
the way a lot of people do, a lot of atheist friends of mine just sort of say, oh, it's just nonsense, you know. But because I know a number of Christians who are whom I admire, you know, and who are just as bright as I am, if not brighter, I like to take a balanced view, but I'm not inclined to be a believer as such, but I think disbelief's too easy, etc. I could preach on for hours, but basically I don't like simplicity and overconfidence. You know, I like people to be not overconfident about the next world.
If it were simple enough to dismiss, it wouldn't be a question.
I just wonder the haste at which people do dismiss it, because a lot of powerful intellects have worked on it for 3,000 or 4,000 years, you know, if not longer. So it's still pretty meaningful, Aboriginal religion or preoccupation or spiritual. That seems pretty everyday. You see people who drive up in a Toyota and then stop and then talk to the spirit ancestors before they go onto the land and that sort of thing. Right. They don't make a big fuss about it. It just seems sort of natural.
I think sometimes your way in your poems of expressing a kind of agnosticism, and it doesn't matter if it's a secular poem
That's
or not,
right.
is the way that you use negatives and prefaces here. So single women in their latter 70s are not uninterested in men.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? That phrasing is a kind of agnostic.
Yeah, like a double negative sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So you do it
and
even...
a tendency to sort of qualify all mm-hmm. the time. It's a bit of a weakness, but it can be a stylistic marker as well.
I see it as a way of making sort of an intellectual space.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a way to hedge an acknowledgement of considering.
Yeah, certainly in no hurry to dismiss things, you know.
I think it's a kind of grace when you can consider all the options.
It's sometimes mistaken for conservatism, you know,
mm.
Because you're not taking a hard stand, you know, and you sort of go, I'll just stroke your beard for a minute, and that's taken as being conservative, you know. You have to watch out for that a bit.
That's kind of interesting.
Especially when you're already old and male. And
you embrace the unknowable, in a sense,
yeah.
and you allow for the validity of sort of sentiments or
right.
intuitions that people have about these things.
Yeah.
That has an interesting relation to something I noticed throughout 101 Poems, which is that you're at pains almost to be clear in what you're saying.
Yeah.
Why is that? That's, in a sense, is not a common feature of poetry in the 21st century.
Alas. I just like to consider the reader. I don't like people to have to struggle too much to get some sort of basic literal meaning out of the poem. You know, I do think that good poems need to be read several times, but I think you have to get something on the first time. So I'm reluctant to let too much. I mean, there's a certain amount of obscurity inevitable, and even a small amount desirable, you know, like some of the obscurance of Wallace Stevens. That doesn't worry me a minute, you know. But I just like things to be reasonably clear. But I'm clearly expressing agnostic ideas, if you like. You know, that's what you're saying. I think that that does seem a bit paradoxical.
It seems to me if you're expressing uncertainty, you have to be pretty clear about it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Especially in this current climate.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be attacked from all sides. You know? Yeah.
I wondered actually what your bearing is towards metaphysics, because I remember that there's the poem about Thomas Tranströmer.
Yeah.
And it's almost, I get the sense that you're rather sceptical of metaphysics.
I am, but moments like that, you know, I think, wow, you know, that's a... That train stopped, you know, and no moon, just stars and so on. I don't know if he was a Christian or not. He was a Swede, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Swedes have got an interesting take on Christianity, which some people are quite persuaded by. But I'm certainly impressed by it. You know, that's more or less an official religion, and they turn up on the relevant. It goes a part of the culture, but they don't take it too seriously, and they don't agonise about, do I believe or... don't I believe, you know, they just turn up.
Right, right.
Which, sing along.
Right, exactly. Turning up maybe is...
They don't have these big moments like, you know, the...
Yeah. He was a psychologist, no?
He was a psychologist, yeah.
Poem ending with two lines by Thomas Tranströmer. Do not read his poems quickly, 3 or 4 a day at most. Do not think too much about those stationary trains stranded in a field of moonlight. Be alert for metaphysics slanting like the sun neatly under morning doors. He too is an agnostic, but hears a stronger whisper in bells and pauses longer watching churches underneath a winter sky. Remember, this is muted music. His Swedish is unreachable. Translation is a neighbour's wall. You'll find a schoolboy there as well, collecting and preserving beetles. Neutral in a run of summers, spared from World War II. Of course, not every entry works. There's too much risk for that. And when attempting the ineffable, not every window will be clean. Forget the prize from dynamite. Unsought and not the point. Forget the day job too. Psychology and poetry can both be transcendental. Take them slowly, as I've said. The train is standing quite still. 2 a.m. Bright moonlight. Few stars.
Yeah, I didn't mind being able to get that effect. You know, that's a, he doesn't do it all the time, and it's not always that good, but he's at his best, it's terrific.
I think it's very interesting that for this poem, you ended up in the imperative voice.
Yeah, I don't do that much. I'm getting a bit confident there.
One of the other poets who is not an English-speaking poet that you have a poem about is Cesar Vallejo.
Yeah, well, yeah, I used to teach Latin American literature and translation and always did some Vallejo as well as Neruda and Borges and so on. I don't like all Vallejo, though. Some of the stuff in Triste is sort of too obscure for me, but some of the more direct personal ones later in life, and the particularly one about his brother Miguel, is sort of... It's just so good, you know. And, he's got these phrases which come across in translation. This morning, I put my upper shoulder bones on wrong. Sort of thing in translation. It sounds terrific.
If you were going to try to put into words and describe sort of how you see the life of your poetry, right, over so many decades, how would you describe it? Has it changed?
I don't know. I think I've become more proficient, you know. I don't need as many drafts, you know, to get to a final version. I don't know that my preoccupations have changed radically. Some of my moral preoccupations have sort of evolved, you know. I was preoccupied with World War I for quite a while. I still occasionally write about and then that sort of evolved into a concern with the Aboriginal European interaction, you know, and the morality of what happened there. And... then other things that come up, but I think there's continuity there, the rural background, the Clarence River and so on, that sort of flows through a lot of it, but not absolutely. The recruit. Every now and then you see him replayed on his slice of footage, somewhere in the opening days, short but solid, city hat, 5'6" at best, cigarette between his fingers, flourishing a wisp of smoke. He's glancing back towards the camera, soundless in its shifting greys. It's not long after 6, brushed by 2 hours' worth of schooners and 3 sheets to the wind. His mates have pushed on through the crowd, drawn by something in the yeast or women's whispers just now heard. 6 bob a day, the army says, and Christmas in Berlin. Come on, mate, he hears them calling. Bluey, Jacko, Nobby, Fred. He waves his cigarette at us, then turns to join the dead. I read this one called A Politeness, and I don't think I need to remind people about Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald, who were very prominent in the 1920s and whose work is still amazing. A Politeness. The feeling you might find disturbing at the end is seeing how your life, for all its misadventures, marital and otherwise, has been an all-night Scott and Zelda 1920s, end of summer, mansion by the Hudson sort of party you have crashed, where finally, alone at dawn, scarf retrieved and keys in hand, you're wandering through the shrubbery, toperied by early light, and circling past the extra pool, still splashing with the last hilarity of guests, you're tracking down the hostess, whom you feel the need to thank. I mean, it's interesting in terms of syntax. You know, I've got one very long sentence there that I sort of deliberately sustain. In fact, I think the whole thing is one sentence, actually. And you're not supposed to do that in a lot of writing, you know, you mean that short, sharp, short sentences, etc. But you get a certain effect by just extending. like they call that in fiction, the deferral of reader satisfaction. You've got to be careful not to overdo it.
I think when you can achieve that, it creates, it's using the language itself, right? The grammar to create tension.
You're building it,
but it's so right. subtle and then it's accrued. I think it's marvelous when you can do it.
Yeah. It's a good thing to do. You can't sort of do it. I know, I think about it consciously. It's just some poems that works and you think about it.
You have a lot of poems. You've been really...
Yeah, there's a quantity there, like 24 books or something. Yeah.
That's remarkable. How do you find your way into poems? Some people will hear it. Some people will have an image.
Yeah.
What's your way in?
Yeah, a single line, a single image, or an issue more generally. You know, you think, there's a poem in there somewhere. I'm not sure what it is yet. I might just write one line on a piece of paper and put it in the ideas file. There's lots of different ways, really. I don't know there's any single way, but it often starts with a line from the actual ultimate poem. It could be the last line or the first line, you know, typically.
Mm.
But I haven't got an easy way to tell other people. You'd have to be pretty self-disciplined, systematic, and possibly limited to always rely on the one way in, I think. Poems are based on, some of them purely based on research and observation, but others based on conversation and casual reading, and others based on other people's poems and so on, you know, that you respond to and reply to. Another one, this is Not Quite Nothing, which is as close as I come to a religious poem, I think. A bit of background to this is quite near here, actually. I was walking past the Catholic Cathedral at this time of the year, and there are all those prunus trees out. You know, that was where this idea sort of came to me. And listening to those bells as well, you know, which are pretty noisy. I mean, Not Quite Nothing. An evening of prunus blooms is made more fragile by the bells ringing in both Mass and spring. The story they're supposed to tell has proved too complex: sexless birth, the levitation straight to heaven, the search for extra miracles, the mysteries of 3 and 7. The narrative I'm learning here might be perhaps more simply told. Hellsong preachers threaten fire, but fail to feel the heat and cold so finely balanced in this dusk. Such subtleties resist their powers. Remember, you are not quite nothing, the bells are saying, and the flowers.
There it is again. You are not quite nothing. Right?
Yeah, it's that's right. Yeah, sort of double negative. Yeah, not quite. But it is a positive statement, so I think.
It is.
Yeah, but it's a minimal statement.
Certainly, being from the U.S., I've never lived anywhere except here where people are so a-religious.
I don't know if or that's secular.
And they're quick to tell you they are.
Yeah, they're impatient with belief and religion.
So right. But I like to ponder it.
Yeah, so, I do too.
Yeah.
I find it hard to imagine I'll actually end up there, but it's not totally impossible, you know. And as you're 83, you're starting a bit closer. I'm also sort of non-foundationalist. So I follow the philosophy of Richard Rorty, American philosopher who died about 10 years ago. And he's an American pragmatist, slightly influenced by postmodernism, but he is anti-foundationalist. He actually is a bit of an atheist rather than an agnostic, but his philosophy leads more toward agnosticism, I think. He just talks about how you can never really be sure. That people have an ultimate vocabulary of things that they believe in, but it's subjective to them, you know. All you can do is talk among people about their final vocabulary and you can get somewhere that's better than where you started, you know, that sort of thing. It's pragmatic.
Mm-hmm. Pragmatic yet hopeful.
That's right. Even more than hopeful, he was quite a political sort of person, believed in the old American left, you know, and the unions and so on.
Right.
So he lamented the fact that the sort of postmodern left was so theoretical and impractical and sort of unsuccessful, really, in my view.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Just lay back and let the capital state or neoliberalism run over them, you know.
So, right.
Yeah.
It seems that something, when you're growing up in Grafton, appealed to you about American culture, and particularly jazz.
Well, I've loved jazz longer than I've loved poetry, and and I've followed in detail for 60 years now. And I'm an amateur musician, not very good, but I play with other people a little bit and so on. And, well, once a fortnight and so on. But the question is, you know, why jazz? Jazz and poetry, I've thought about the similarities and differences. They are pretty different. There's an analogy, obviously, between poetry and classical music. You're trying to write something that's perfect and then it'll be performed subsequently. I don't believe in sort of improvising poetry, you know, like spontaneous rap or freestyle rap. Well, I mean, it's there, but I don't have any temptation to try it. But there's lots of things I like about jazz. I think it's got an important freedom that some other musics don't emphasise anyway. Yeah.
What do you play?
Vibraphone. It has a beautiful sound, I think. A good one, and if it's well played, you know, Milt Jackson. So.
How did you find jazz, and how did you find poetry?
Well, I found jazz in 1956 when I was 16, when I heard a bit of it on the radio, and a couple of friends I had at school I met them again later years, and they don't seem to follow it in the way I have, but we were sort of pretty snooty about rock that was just coming on the scene then, like Elvis Presley and Bill Haley, and we thought that jazz was just so much more sophisticated.
Mm.
And so we would resist rock, you know, with other people listening to it, and we'd say, you should listen to this, the Jerry Mulligan Quartet, you know, with Chet Baker and so on. And also, the drama of it, like Louis Armstrong and all these sort of posturing and so on, the handkerchief and sweating. Also, Gene Krupa, the drummer with Benny Goodman. Mm. You see video of that or film of that, or even just photos, you know, look so frenetic and sort of look like something good. I used to play drums, but I didn't ever take proper lessons and I never got at all good. You know, I'm better at vibes than I was at drums.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So I've just loved it for a long time. And it's a whole world, you know, there's lots of different sorts of jazz. And I have a particular focus on one period in about 1955-65 called Hard Bop. With people like Art Blakey and Cannibal Adderley and so on. But there's lots of other good stuff. It's just subjective, you know.
Sometimes when you're listening to a poem, it seems to me that you're listening for the rhythm.
I do.
And that is one thing.
You mean you or us or me?
You.
I do.
Yeah, you. I mean,
you in
particular.
I can just hear a line, repeat it, and I can just see where all the stresses fall. You know?
You can.
I'm sort of counting as someone's a wave in the air.
Right. I think I've seen you do that. Yeah, and so that's how I know this.
Yeah. And the more often I do that, the more attracted I am to the poem. You know, when I hear a rhythm that's really there, then I like it. But the offside of that is the other way that you'd think my poetry would be more flexible and more rhythmically complex, you know.
Mm.
Yeah. But I tend towards a fairly rhythmic, fairly straightforward iambic tetrameter or trimeter. And I just like the sound of that. For me, but I like the sound of free verse for William Carlos Williams and others.
How did you find poetry?
I found when I was doing a short. I wanted to be a novelist, and I was very impressed by William Faulkner, the American novelist who leads on to Cormac McCarthy and so on. And I did a creative writing course just for about 3 or 4 months. And during that time, I had an idea that didn't work as a short story, and I tried it again as a poem with a suggestion of the teacher, and it just worked so much better as a poem than it was working as a story. And I found I just avoided cliches more often with poetry than with stories. And gradually I started to read more poetry. I was teaching poetry as part of the English course, but not usually the poetry that I'd automatically seek out myself. But then I just started reading more poetry myself in my mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
And had the first poem published. I was about 27, first book published 31. So I was a bit of a latecomer compared to jazz, for instance. But I was better at poetry than I am at jazz.
Mm.
I love jazz just as much.
You've gathered the poems from 2011 to 2021 in 101 poems.
Yeah.
What's new?
There's a new book coming out late this year, early next year, called Penultima, Penultima. And that's the best of what I've written in, since then, really. Because it's quite hard to put together. There's another book floating around at the same time, almost as big, which I put aside. I raided that and put some of the things from that in this one. So I've probably got, I would have another book after this one, more or less in production, you know, sort of. So I'm still going, yep.
Who's publishing Penultima?
Pitt Street. Yeah,
Pitt Street? Still,
they've been very faithful to it. They have done me well.
Is Jeff Page surprised at 83 to find himself an elder of Australian poetry, a successor to poets like A.D. Hope, David Campbell, Rosemary Dobson, and others who were prominent when he began?
Well, yeah, I find myself in their position. Now, maybe I'm not quite as luminous as they were, and times have changed a bit, you know, in the situation of the mineral complex. So. But I do feel a responsibility to go to things the way, like Rosemary Dobson, well into her mid-80s, she used to come to readings, you know, it was quite a struggle for her, and she got somebody to bring her in. It just encouraged people of that generation cared about what was happening in the next, you know. It made you feel as though you're part of something that's ongoing. And I do feel a responsibility to try to get to younger people's stuff.
And you have your monthly...
Yeah, I'm still running that.
Yeah, that you do at Smith's.
There's more of a sense of the value of public presentation of poetry now, isn't there, than there was?
Oh, yeah.
I don't recall A.D. Hope really...
He did read a little bit, and there were some readings, but they were pretty quiet, sort of half-apologetic affairs, and people were pretty nervous about it. And David Campbell, he used to... I remember I heard him read about 1960, and then at the end of his life, 1978, and he just gradually got better and better at it, and he was quite a presence, physical presence and so on. But he used to drink a bit to prime himself up, you know, and he slurred the syllables a bit, but gradually he got better, and then he was really good. You know. Alec was great to listen to, you know. If you hear him read Death of a Bird, it's just profoundly moving, you know, it's just a...
Resonant.
Yeah, resonant. Well, the imagery's so good, and the metrics are all sort of really subtle. He was, you know, everything you could want in a poet, pretty much. But I don't follow him in terms of technical. I don't feel drawn to iambic pentameter quatrains and so on exactly the way he did.
Yeah, yeah, in a way he was the last of a breed, in a sense, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, yeah. It was almost, some people used to joke, he was Australia's greatest 18th century poet. That wouldn't have been hard. You know, Baron Feeley wrote something about 1798 here, which is really appalling, about a kangaroo.
Jeff Page hosts a monthly reading at Smith's Alternative, Jeff's Poetry, as well as a monthly jazz night, Jeff's Jazz. For Art Sound Poetry on the Radio, I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, October 2, at Smith's Alternative in Civic, Jeff's Poetry presents Luke Fisher and Jenny Kamar Martinello, There's No Open Mic. Luke Fisher is a Sydney-based poet, philosopher, writer, and scholar of poetry, whose volumes of verse include A Gamble for My Daughter, Vagabond Press 2022. His scholarly publications include The Poet as Phenomenologist, Rilke and the New Poems. Jenny Kamar Martinello, OAM, is an award-winning poet, writer, visual artist, and academic of Arendt, Chinese, and Anglo-Celtic descent, who has won several awards for her poetry. As a glass artist, she's renowned for her vessels inspired by traditional woven forms. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Art Blakey and Clifford Brown's A Night at Birdland, Volume 1, from 1954. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.